Red Ice members, thank you very much for staying with us and tuning in here to our second segment with David Livingstone, author of The Dying God and Terrorism and the Illuminati. And why not begin here to talk about Al-Qaeda in this segment, this modern kind of boogeyman, I guess, for many people living in the West. I'd like to hear, David, a little bit on your background in regards to what you found regarding these guys. Would you say that this is an organization that is Muslim at its core, or is there another story here? I'm primarily, of course, thinking of the connection with some of the more Western intelligence agencies. David, what do you think?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's going on with that. I mean, I know that they have ties with the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's where it gets fishy. And definitely, you know, how they were sponsored, then you can pretty much assume the rest. There's a couple of few people who, like I mentioned in my book, there's a couple of, like the main ideologue of basically the jihad movement in Afghanistan was an activist named Abdullah Azam. And he was the main one who kind of riled, you know, called for the jihad in Afghanistan and things like that. There was one source that claims that he was a CIA agent. The same source claims that Omar, the blind sheikh, was also a CIA agent. But
do you think that could be true?
Yeah, I think it's very likely. I mean, the jihad in Afghanistan was the largest CIA operation in history. And, you know, the way through which the Americans fought the Soviet Union was by financing the so-called Mujahideen.
Yes. And this is, and do you think Al-Qaeda is an offshoot of that?
Well, it is that. I mean, the first organization that they used was led by Hikmatyar.
Okay.
And he was a member of he founded a party in Afghanistan. And that was again an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I have to explain what I discovered about the Muslim Brotherhood to give a real sense of what that means.
Yeah.
And of course this is all financed through Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's the other factor in this.
So the Wahhabis, right?
Exactly. So the two key players in this is the Salafi reform movement, of which the Muslim Brotherhood is an offshoot, and the second one is the Wahhabis. But basically, Salafi and Wahhabis at this time are pretty much one and the same. So I think what we should do is go back to the Asiatic Brethren, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, sure.
So as I said, the Asiatic Brethren, founded by Jacob Frank's nephew, also basically, according to Albert Pike, then succeeded the Illuminati, was responsible, and again, was named in reference to the Sabians / Mandane / Ismailis / assassins of the Islamic world. They were responsible largely for the spread of Egyptian, where they're closely aligned to Egyptian, to what are called fringe, what's called a fringe faction of Freemasonry, which is Egyptian Rite Freemasonry,
uh-huh. Okay.
And which was originally founded by Cagliostro. And the other offshoot was the English Rosicrucians. And this emerged out of the Golden Rosicrucians, which again is affiliated with the Asiatic Brethren. And so what happens is that when Napoleon is in Egypt, Masons in his army then set out to make contact who they believed were the lost remnants of the Ismaili tradition in Egypt, or what they considered, because again, the Sabians supposedly preserved the Hermetic tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because Hermetic tradition was considered to be the ancient Egyptian occult tradition. And this is what the Templars had supposedly learned from these Ismailis in Egypt, who had preserved this Hermetic tradition. So now these late 18th century Masons were again trying to make contact, as the Templars did, with this Ismaili Hermetic tradition in Egypt.
Okay.
And which I would presume is the source of, you know, symbolism of the pyramid and things like that. This is why, you know, Egypt has this constant role or symbolism, important symbolism in the occult, is because Hermeticism is considered to be of ancient Egyptian origin, which it isn't, but that's another story. And so this basically explains the basis of the Egyptian Freemasonry, because apparently it was an Egyptian who came back to Europe, a Marconis de Negre. Well, de Negre means the Negro, who founded branches of Egyptian Rite Freemasonry in Europe. So it's out of what they were maintaining was this Shabbatean heritage or Frankist tradition, particularly around rites of sex magic. And this is where you find there's a very excellent book by an author named Greenfield, mm-hmm. about this entire tradition. And so what happened is that I think we talked a little bit about this last time, is the Palladian Rite. Palladian Rite.
Yeah.
You have Albert Pike, who sets out a plan for three world wars in the 20th century, apparently. But he's on the Palladian Rite with him is Lord Palmerston. And Lord Palmerston joins with Edward Bulwer Lytton, who is with the English Rosicrucians.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up a plan to spread Scottish Rite Freemasonry to the Middle East. And so basically you're looking at these movements which emerge out of the Asiatic Brethren are now set to spread Scottish Rite Freemasonry in the Middle East. Their primary agent is Jamal Afghani, who is a guy who claims to be an Afghani, but he's doing that to hide the fact that he's Iranian.
Okay.
Because if he is Iranian, it means that he's Shia, that he is not Sunni, so he could not lead an Islamic reform movement in Egypt, which is Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
There are rumors that he's secretly Jewish. I suspect that he was likely Ismaili, because that explains a lot, because the assassins were Ismaili. What happens at this time is that you have what in Europe is what's called the occult revival. You have all of a sudden this huge propaganda being put out by the occult underground that had largely remained underground until this time, but now they're kind of basically becoming a lot more popular. And this has to do with orders like the Golden Dawn and things like that, but most importantly, Helena Blavatsky. And Helena Blavatsky writes two books called License Unveiled, and what's the other one? Anyway, these two books are considered the Bibles of Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also considered the godmother of the New Age movement. And what she does is she takes basically the Aryan myth that had been formulated at the beginning of the 1800s.
Yes.
And takes that Aryan concept and melds it with occult legends. So then she's the one who develops this idea of the Aryans originating Atlantis and where they had learned the secret doctrine, and that they survived by going to the mountains in the Himalayas, particularly the Gobi Desert, where the Great White Brotherhood is set up, and so on and so forth. Basically the entire basis that Hitler then later appropriated about 50 years later.
That's true, but there needs to be, I think, in that context, also mention a few more names in regards to who were behind at least Hitler. I'm thinking of people like Jürg Lanz von Liebenfeld, Dietrich Eckart, just to mention a few that actually was very much instrumental in also helping shaping and forming the kind of occult agenda of the Third Reich. But I just want to put that in there. But go ahead, David.
And this is important because that group, which is most closely affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, is Nazis. And today, neo-Nazis. So that's why I want to give the background to this.
Yes.
So the person apparently that who Blavatsky got her doctrines from was Jamal Afghani. And from her, from him, she basically, this is according to H. Paul Johnson, and he claims that what she got from him was an Ismaili interpretation of, Ismaili slash Gnostic. This is where she got the source of her Ismaili slash Gnostic doctrines. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the beginning of it. It also seems that they travel together regularly to India. And what he's doing when he goes to India is that he's first of all, he's posing as a preacher for the Baha'i movement, which is another offshoot, which is very interesting.
Yeah, I know.
And then he's also visiting the Aga Khan, because this is a period when, after which the Aga Khan had moved from Iran and set up, established himself in India. So very firmly bases Afghani in the Ismaili, in this entire occult movement in the Ismaili tradition. And there's a number of others who traveled to Egypt at this time, like Carl Kellner, Carl Royce, Theodore Royce, all the guys who are affiliated with the English Rosicrucians, with the Golden Dawn, with the Theosophical Society, with Egyptian Freemasonry. And they come back to Europe and they create an order called the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, which is based off of Afghani's Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And out of this, and this is how you get the Golden Dawn and eventually Aleister Crowley, who creates the OTO. Creates the OTO, or yeah, eventually heads the OTO. Mm-hmm. And out of the OTO comes the Nazis. So this is how Afghani is responsible for two branches of the occult underground. One, which is the OTO, very importantly, and again, the occult background of the Nazis. And in the Islamic world, he becomes the founder of a movement or so-called reform movement called the Salafi movement. And this is a movement that was ostensibly aiming at a return to pure Islam and throwing off the yoke of British colonialism and things like that. But really, it was another way to undermine Islam. And so Afghani was the teacher of Muhammad Abdu, who was again a British agent. They appointed him as head of the Al-Azhar University, where he eventually started putting forward fatwas that were designed to, furtively support British agenda in the country. Abdu is the teacher of a man called Rashid Rida. And Rashid Rida is the first one to establish ties with Saudi Arabia. And we can get back to that in a second. Okay. Because this is, it's key. And Rashid Rida was the teacher of Hassan al-Banna. Wow. And Hassan al-Banna is the one who founds the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
And he founds the Muslim, this is what was discovered by John Loftus. And John Loftus is basically a Nazi hunter. But he was allowed access to a number of old CIA documents. And what he discovered is that Hassan al-Banna was recruited by Hitler to create an arm of British intelligence in the Middle East, particularly Egypt, I guess. So he creates the Muslim Brotherhood to act as that vehicle. And so this is where basically you're seeing the reconnection of these, on the surface, one is supposedly a Sufi Muslim reformer. The other one is, an Aryan supremacist, but really at the core, they're members of the same underlying organization, just using different fronts to achieve their objectives. Mm. And, so what happens is that when the Nazis lose World War II, then the CIA then come in and take control of the Muslim Brotherhood away from the Nazis. Because really the Nazis, they didn't really lose a heck of a lot. They might have lost in the publicity, but they all the leading SS officers and were hired by the Nazis. By the CIA.
Right.
This is very well known. It was part of, a number of them were hired under Operation Paperclip,
mm-hmm.
where they were hired to work with NASA and other, scientific projects in the U.S. An important component was what's called the Odessa Networks, which was used to tell or basically help a lot of these guys escape. And the primary places where they were taken were South America, which is very well known.
Yeah.
The other one is Egypt, where they were hired to train assist and control the Muslim Brotherhood. And the other one is Italy. In Italy, they created what's called the Gladio Networks.
Yes.
The stay behind lines, and who were eventually helped in development or creation of the Red Brigade. So just terrorism, terrorism is all the same, right? It's a modern production that basically dates back to Bakunin. It has nothing to do with Islam. It's an atheistic, Luciferian approach to political subversion. And so Italy is a branch. The other one is Egypt. And the key trainer was a man named Otto Skorzeny, who was Hitler's bodyguard. And the other one was Reinhard Gehlen, who of course, basically was the leader of this entire, former Nazi network, former SS network, also responsible for espionage in the States. And, what was revealed, which is very interesting, was revealed by Miles Copeland, in the game. I think it's a book called The Game Player. Miles Copeland was in charge his post was in Egypt, and he was working with, Gamal Nasser, who was then president of Egypt. And what happened is that when Gamal Nasser turned against the U.S., they tried to use the Muslim Brotherhood to assassinate him. And the attempt failed. So Gamal Nasser had them all rounded up, and, a number of them were executed. Most importantly, Said Qutb was considered one of the great ideologues, not only of the Muslim Brotherhood, but of Islam in the 20th century.
Was, sorry to cut you off, but Qutb wasn't the, I think this was one of the main characters that Adam Curtis looked into in his Power of Nightmares video series. I don't know if you got a chance to see that, but we're talking about the same one here.
Yes, okay. Highly recommend that documentary. Doesn't cover everything.
No, of course not.
But it gives you a good background on a number of issues.
Yes, okay.
And so in these, quote-unquote interrogations, which I guess some of them would have been pretty brutal, what they revealed, and this is what Miles Copeland reveals, a CIA agent at the time, he says that what the interrogations discovered was that the Muslim Brotherhood was a tool of that could be used at the whim of the American, French, German, Russian, and British intelligence services.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that the CIA then, because of the persecution that they're undergoing now in Egypt, the CIA assists a number of them by helping them leave Egypt, but establishes them in Saudi Arabia. And and there they're given posts as religious instructors. I can't remember where I learned this from, either from John Lostis, or the other interesting book is the one by Robert Bayer, which is Sleeping with the Enemy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that also has a few interesting revelations. So the CIA sets them up in Saudi Arabia, points them as religious teachers. One of the most important ones is Muhammad Qutb, who's the brother of Said Qutb.
Mm-hmm.
And Muhammad Qutb, this is how bin Laden befriends Muhammad Qutb, and this is how he basically gets recruited to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm.
And this is at the point basically where we could go back now and explain the role of Saudi Arabia.
Okay, and the Wahhabis, because this is the tribe that was put into place then of to head Saudi Arabia, I guess, right?
Exactly. So, or the sect that was used to. What happened is that, this is another aspect of history that Westerners are largely completely unaware of, which is the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
And, when we hear about the Middle Ages, we usually hear about what happens in Europe, and maybe the Renaissance as referred to as an important period or some kind of a cultural arrival. But really, the the Middle Ages were dominated by the Ottoman Empire, which is the great empire at the time. And so when the British started to expand in power and started to colonize certain parts of the world, they employed what's called the strategy of divide and conquer, right? It's very well known.
Yes.
They're a tiny, tiny little island that eventually managed to control 3/4 of the world's surface, but they did so largely through deception. So they had to find a way to undermine the Ottoman Empire. So they had to pit Muslim against Muslim. And so the way they did that, now there's a fascinating story called The Memoirs of Mr. Hempfer. They're very easy to find online. It's really an astounding story. And this is a guy who claims to have been sent by the British to find a way to undermine the Ottoman Empire. And he does his studies, he travels, and eventually he picks up on this one guy who he finds is corruptible enough that he's going to be able to work with him. And this is a guy named Muhammad Abdul Wahab. And so eventually they find, you know, they kind of tempt him with various ways of committing, you know, what are considered rather grave sins in Islam to determine for sure that this guy is corruptible, that he's a hypocrite. So they eventually recruit him into working for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they take him back to Saudi Arabia, and it's from there. And at that point, they align him with a man named Ibn Saud. And they decide at that point that Ibn Saud will be the political leader and Wahab will be the source of the doctrine that this movement will enforce. But really the source of it is the British. So how do you convince one Muslim to fight another? It's not allowed in Islam. There's no way. Islam is supposed to establish a brotherhood so that there is no, you know, there's no killing others, there's no fighting other Muslims. The only way you can do it is by pronouncing another Muslim a non-Muslim, and then supposedly it depends on some, you know, in this is what Wahab argued, that then jihad becomes mandatory against those apostates.
Mm-hmm.
And what he used a very, very, very weak argument. And this was at a time when the British were already starting to encroach on portions of the peninsula. And instead of, you know, turning Muslim attention to this threat, he turns attention to the issue of praying to saints. And at this time, Muslims were in the habit. Am I going too deeply?
Well, we're getting a little bit off track, but continue.
We'll a little bit off track, but yeah. It's the only way to make sense of it.
I won't
go too far.
No, it's okay. We got to go through some of the background here. It's fine, David.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I'm looking at the time, and it seems like we have enough time. Some Muslims would say, they would say, oh, such and such a saint, you know, pray on my behalf to God.
Mm-hmm.
So this is important to point out how weak this excuse was that the Wahhab and the British used to turn these people into fanatics.
Okay.
And to disunite the Ottoman Empire. And so he said that this asking, you know, intercession through a saint is an act of idolatry. It means that you have forfeited your faith. It means that you have apostatized, that you are an unbeliever because you have treated that person as a god, so that you have apostatized.
Mm.
So basically he claimed that because this practice was common, that all the generations of Islam between himself and the earliest generations of Islam had fallen out of Islam, and that they basically had not been Muslim. So he called on his followers to reject this entire Islamic tradition and to fight it. That he essentially declared jihad on the Muslim world. So they began by fighting in Arabia, and they seized a number of important places. They destroyed shrines. They destroyed, you know, all kinds of relics, and they massacred people. They enslaved women and children, you know, all on the basis of this claim that people were that asking intercession from saints was this, you know, catastrophic sin. But obviously they were in service of the British. What happens then, though, is that the Ottoman Empire decides to step in, and they eventually squash the movement. But it survives in a very, very small group in a portion of Saudi Arabia, where they managed to retain their Wahhabi traditions.
Okay.
And so, interestingly, is that when the British finally defeat the Ottoman Empire, you know, and the primary reason for that was to free Israel from Ottoman control. There's two agents that were very important in this. One was Lawrence of Arabia, who was working in who was working with Faisal, and the other one was Philby. I think I just was working with Ibn Saud. So the British promised Faisal that if he assisted them against the Ottoman Empire, first of all, at this point the Ottoman Empire had already been overthrown by the Young Turks, right? By who were Secret Domini.
Okay.
And Afghani again was assisting the Young Turks in their revolution. So they convinced Faisal, who was the Sharif of Mecca, so essentially, you know, a leader in Saudi Arabia, that if he helps the British in fight the Turks, that the British will make him king of the Arabs. But what the British do in secret, without telling Faisal, is they sign the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which decides to divide up the Middle East between the British and the French.
Okay.
And you know, the French get Lebanon, the British get Palestine and Iraq, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So Faisal, assisted by Lawrence of Arabia, it's a famous movie, you can watch the whole thing, they seize Damascus, and he goes right ahead and declares himself king of the Arabs. And then the British are like, actually, you know, they basically reveal to him that they have a secret plan for him, and he ends up finally established only receiving Jordan. And this is where the family is descended from. And then go forth ahead, and because the British government had already written a letter to Rothschild called the Balfour Agreement,
yes,
promising Israel to Rothschild,
yes,
and the Zionist movement. So Faisal is supposed to be king of Saudi Arabia as well as all the Arab lands. But instead, they assist Ibn Saud in seizing control of Saudi Arabia. And Ibn Saud, who happens to be the descendant of the first Ibn Saud, who had originally aligned with Wahhab to try to spread this Wahhabi cult. A year later is the year where Ibn Saud signs deals to grant drilling rights to Rockefeller and his drilling rights in Saudi Arabia, and of course the well is discovered immediately after,
right.
And the rest is history. Right, so it's a very, very close relationship, and it goes all the way back to that point. But what happens, the most important period is 1973. And the book I suggest reading at this point is called A Century of War by William Engel. This is, I rank this in one of the most, you know, of my list of must reads.
Okay. A Century of War by William Engel, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And he points out in this book that the oil crisis was largely orchestrated by, Kissinger. And that plans had already been set in advance that any monies that the Saudi Arabia would receive would be deposited in Chase Bank in New York, which again was a Rockefeller holding.
Right, right.
So this happens at an opportune time. So as planned, I believe as discussed as a Bilderberg meeting, the price of oil was quadrupled. And of course, you know, Saudi Arabia becomes filthy rich overnight.
Yes.
And Kissinger comes up with this really evil plan. He had a list, I can't remember what the memorandum is called, but he had a list of nations that were overly developed, he felt, and that needed to be sent back to the Middle Ages. And so what he developed is this plan called petrodollar recycling.
Mm-hmm.
And this is amazing and it's evil. So Saudi Arabia, basically, you know, Saudi Arabia takes all this money, dumps it into Chase Bank, and now that the third world is clamoring for money to try to buy this expensive oil, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have to go there, go and they borrow that same money, which their money, which got deposited into Chase Bank to buy the oil that they couldn't afford.
Mm-hmm.
Petrodollar recycling is what it's called.
Yes.
But the key,
this is in the same. I mean, wasn't it the U.S. Later on here that ran into this so-called scarcity, where you know there wasn't enough oil, you know?
Exactly. And the debt crisis.
Yes.
I can't remember what you said. And but the key point in all of this is that now Saudi Arabia was awash his money, and this is also what happened is that. After the Watergate scandal emerged, then the CIA was pretty its hands was pretty tied. Then they had to pass everything through Congress. So they decided that they made a deal with Saudi Arabia that the way to get around all of this, the way to get around, you know, running their projects through Congress for approval. Instead, they could have it financed by Saudi Arabia.
Mm.
So they figured this was perfect. And the first thing they started doing was supporting the Contras. And there you have the beginnings of the Iran-Contra affair.
Yes.
And this took place at a time when an excellent book is by Robert Dreyfus. It's called Hostage to Khomeini. Mm-hmm. It's amazing in what it reveals. Unfortunately, it doesn't provide a lot of sources. So you got to double check everything, but it's amazing. And this is the book that totally reveals the relationship between the Freemasons and their creation of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Okay.
And the reason he does that is because he goes on to show that the Muslim Brotherhood assisted in the installation of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And essentially that the Ayatollah was a British agent.
Hmm. Yeah.
So right after he's installed, the, you know, America's called the Great Satan, blah, blah, blah. And they swear not to trade with terrorists, but they do. And this was an illegal action. This was the whole point of the investigation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they start trading with the Iranians. And what they're doing is, and this is where, Curtis's, movie is important. But this is where he explains most of the scenario.
The power of nightmares.
Yes, because at this point, this is when the U.S. is looking for a way to destroy the Soviet Union. And this is where you have to look at the Bernard Lewis plan and Brzezinski and his Arctic crisis and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And what they want to do is destroy the Soviet Union. So they figure the way to do so is by financing Islamic fundamentalism.
Mm.
As a bulwark against Soviet communism. And this is the plan. So the way to do so is with off-the-shelf kind of, you know, financing that is going to be funneled, is going to be provided by Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And is going to be, it's going to come from oil money, but it's also going to come from drug money. And the key money laundering operation at this point is a bank called BCCI. Which underwent the famous scandal. This was achieved a lot of acclaim at the time because it was the first third world enterprise to achieve any kind of status.
Okay.
But I think it was Casey, who called it a banks of crooks and criminals. Right, sure. I mean, it was dirty to the core. Everybody was involved in there. You know, it's all, you know, the South American cartels, you know, it's, you really at this point, you have to read my book to get all the details, but it's, yeah. It was thoroughly immersed in basically laundering, Iran-Contra money and then, channeling that money to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And so what was going on essentially is that the arms were being traded with Iran illegally, and then those were being sold to the Contras for cocaine. And that cocaine was being dropped off in MENA, Arkansas.
Yes.
Which was basically under Clinton's supervision.
Yes.
Exactly. The main guy at that point was Barry Seal.
Yeah.
And another very interesting tangent from this story is Barry Seal was recruited into the CIA the very same weekend and very same camp as Oswald.
That's interesting.
If you want to, yeah, there's a very excellent documentary online about that called JFK2.
Okay. Yeah. That's
and true. The other documentary I'd recommend is Barry and the Boys by Hopsicker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating stuff. So, so all this money gets dropped off in MENA, then it gets distributed to ghettos, in the black gangs, particularly in LA, and kicks off the crack epidemic.
Mm.
Which was revealed by Gary Webb and his, Dark Alliance is what it's called?
I'm not sure. Gary Webb.
But this is a story that actually reached the light of the day that the CIA was distributing cocaine.
Yes.
And this has hit mainstream press. Except that the way that the media works is that they just never refer to it again. Right?
Well, exactly. It ends up, in the back of the paper or in the fine print somewhere, and then it doesn't mention, you know, it says, and again, this is something that still continues to this day. I mean, they caught a plane just the other day that was, had CIA, registering plates on it that were carrying, I think, 800 kilos or something like that of cocaine, you know, so, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, drug money is the key to financing for black operations, and it has been. The interesting thing is that it goes right back to Lord Palmerston, who again was on the Palladian right, and coordinated with Bulwer Lytton to spearhead this project to spread Scottish Rite Freemasonry to the rest, and of course then recruited Afghani, because Lord Palmerston was Prime Minister of England at the time of the Opium Wars. Right?
Yeah.
Which is basically a strategy of inundating China with opium as a way of demoralizing and defeating that country. And that's when Britain basically began the process of monopolizing the world's drug trade. And that, centralized in Asia and still is to this point, right? It's still all funneled through Hong Kong. And the gangs like the Triads, that's when British coordination with the Triads began.
Right.
And that just evolved over time, you know, and in the 20th century it evolved into Vietnam and then eventually Afghanistan.
Drugs, and all, money, war, it's all connected at the highest levels, obviously, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think also that this again ties back into the whole story of Afghanistan and the growth of the poppy fields and the fact that this is something that has increased since the Taliban has been so-called thrown out or they've taken care of the region and now the poppy production or the opium production is back on the same levels as they were before the time the U.S. were in there, you know. So,
and you know, not only was Karzai a former was he a board member or director of, was it Unocal or whatever the company was that was trying to build a pipeline?
Not sure.
His brother, you just Google it, his brother is like a major drug kingpin in the country.
Okay. Jeez, my God. It's incredible. It's an incredible story. And this is all connected in that sense. And do you think also then that all the money for that is coming in through all of these illegal activities regarding war, regarding drugs and so forth, is something that also financed the whole terrorism action that we were kind of alluding to before, you know, in regards to Al-Qaeda, in regards to I mean, again, Al-Qaeda is even there, or Afghanistan, that has a background or a connection with the Iran-Contra affairs, like an offshoot of everything. It doesn't just, one thing doesn't just start off and then end off. It's like everything is, it's a red line through all of these things, right?
Oh, absolutely not. They got to a point where the Americans supposedly felt that they needed more forces in Afghanistan. So they decided that they needed to start recruiting Muslims from around the world to come and join the fight.
Okay, yeah.
And so they went to Saudi Arabia and they said, you know, give us a leader who can kind of spearhead this rallying cry. So they found Bin Laden.
Right, right.
And Bin Laden was the chief leader of this, you know, basically he was the one that was recruited. You have to Google this as well too, that there was a point where Bin Laden was brought to the U.S. as Tim Osman.
Yes, that's right.
And so Bin Laden basically features in this project right from the very beginning, and undergoes this worldwide recruitment campaign all over, you know, different Muslim communities all over. And this happened in the U.S., in various mosques all over the U.S., in Europe, you know, where they would show, you know, jihad tapes and things like that about the great glorious fight in Afghanistan and calling all these guys to go support the CIA struggle in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Being duped all the while that it was you know, in service of Islam. And many, many did. And this is why the chief ideologue and also a friend of Muhammad Qutb in Saudi Arabia was Abdullah Azzam.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who basically formulated the fatwa that you could call it, that was used to, you know, justify this, you know, that getting on a plane and traveling halfway around the world to go fight the evil infidel, you know, and right. Your service of Islam, really just serving a CIA operation. So, they were all interconnected, obviously.
So let's see here if we can, you know, tie this together a little bit then with, I mean, we obviously talked about the connection here with 9/11, as you alluded to in the end here. We had, you know, Madrid, we had the London bombings, all this stuff. And I guess the latest version of that, as we've seen right now, is the Mumbai attacks in India. What do you see there as the background story? Is this the same? I haven't followed actually the story that closely, but it's the same basic thing that is being drawn out. Although the fact is that this seemed to be some kind of you know, Hindi group behind it. What have you found? Have you researched this anything, David?
Well, you know, the claim, which is pretty obvious, is that it was going to be the ISI that was responsible. The ISI is the Pakistani Secret Service.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, as if this is supposed to be a big surprise, because the ISI was the arm through which the CIA worked to coordinate the so-called Mujahideen in Afghanistan for 20 years. Mm. You know, I mean, Bin Laden and all these Mujahideen organizations were coordinating with the ISI. So, and the BCCI bank, you know, so they were all interconnected way back. So of course, you know, the ISI has been responsible for false flag operations. I didn't, you know, what I, as far as I understand, is that this was designed to put some pressure on Pakistan.
Okay. Really? Because I think that, it seems to be very much the old, again, tying back to the old, idea of the class of civilizations here is something that is prominent, because this is spreading globally all over the world, and every country should feel insecure, should feel, you know, that there's terrorists everywhere around the corner. And what do you think is the kind of the remedy that they will offer to this artificially created type of problem that is terrorism?
Right. Well, you know, the amazing thing is if you go back to a letter that was supposedly written by Albert Pike, and this is reported in William Guy Carr's Pawns in the Game.
Yes.
And he reports that Albert Pike apparently outlined, so this book was written way back in the 50s, and yet outlines that there's a plan for three world wars, that the first one was to be against the Soviet Union, against create the threat of socialism. The Second World War would be against Nazism.
Germany,
and the third World War would be against the Islamic world.
Yeah.
So amazingly prescient for a book that was written way back in the 50s.
And he alluded to these documents, and I think there was talk about that these were on display or something for a while
Exactly.
I can't remember exactly what it was, but there has been questions about the authenticity of the mails, because this was something he sent back and forth to Giuseppe Mazzini, I think, and talked about this, right?
Exactly. So, you know, I don't know how true it is, but it's still pretty accurate.
That's what happened. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I'm just amazed that somebody in the 50s already knew that, that the planned stage for World War III was going to be a war with the Islamic world.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty great foresight.
But do you think it will be? I mean, again, obviously we have to recognize that there is war going on right now, but it's not on the scale, if you know what I mean, as World War I and World War II were. Do you think that will it lead up to this eventually, or what do you think will happen?
I don't know. You know, see, the amazing thing is that the Turks had created a pretty great civilization, but like every civilization, it began to decline. And, you know, you're looking right now at the only time in Islamic history where there's no form of consolidated rule. I mean, the amazing thing is that Brzezinski recognizes it as well, even though he believes in creating this artificial fear. He himself, he says, you know, people criticize us for I can't remember exactly what he said, but approximately what he said, you know, criticize us for our policy on global Islam. He said, there is no global Islam. It is true. You know, Islam is in a complete state of collapse. And I don't mean Islam the religion. I mean the practice of it and the community is completely fractured and disintegrated. Mm-hmm. And this is why, you know, the Wahhabi movement was suppressed when the Ottoman Empire was in power. When it collapsed, the opposite happened. When it collapsed, then they could finally come forward. And what's happening now is that, especially in North America, the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, because they have so much money, they monopolize Islamic literature. I'm not sure how it works in Arabic. Presumably it's the same in Arabic, but definitely is English Islamic literature. Mm-hmm. And they controlled apparently 80% of the mosques in North America. Okay. So, and what they're doing with that is that they're spreading their Wahhabi Salafi approach to Islam, which is a literalist, fanatical, narrow-minded jihad. Most of them, they'll deny their jihadi approach, but it's usually through the Salafi approach that they end up, justifying jihad and eventually terrorism. See, the whole interesting thing about the Albert Pike, thing is that he was on the Palladian, with Bulwer Lytton. Mm-hmm. And Bulwer Lytton was, sorry, not Bulwer Lytton, Lord Palmerston. And as I said before, Lord Palmerston was the guy who headed the project to spread Scottish Rite Freemasonry. So the way that I see it is that they recognized that if they were going to create a war with Islam, it wasn't going to happen, of its own accord.
Right.
They were going to have to create militancy in the Islamic world in order to turn it against the West.
And this is what literature is helping to do now then, and to further spur along this ideology of the clash of civilizations, I guess.
Exactly. Mm. Because if you'll find, if there's any, opponent in the Islamic world, it's the Salafi movement. It's not Islam, you know, the traditional practice of Islam. And that's the point. And all these so-called terrorist groups are always affiliated with some branch of Salafism or Wahhabism. And this includes Pakistan and India. In fact, the two locales where this trend is most localized is Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and parts of India. And there's a number of these offshoot movements, like there's the Hizbi Islami in Pakistan and so on and so forth, and various other little factions that were created, you know, in the period of British power in that country.
Mm.
So that's the point, right? So it's really understanding the scenarios, understanding that these guys had to, and it also helps them to understand what is happening in our times, that you have this puny little fringe of radicalized Muslims who have basically, you know, no, who can't really be compared to the traditional practice of Islam, but are being used to stigmatize, you know, people's perceptions of Islam.
Right, right.
The Taliban is another example. The Taliban were educated in madrasas that were financed by Saudi Arabia in a interpretation of Islam, which is called the Deobandi movement, which is another one. I don't have any proof on it, but I would understand that the Deobandis is another one of these sects that were created by the British in their period in India.
Mm.
So that's why, you know, the Taliban were a caricature of Islam, but used specifically to fan the flames of this so-called classic civilization. And really what's amazing is, as you look at how well planned the whole thing was, is that when they recruited all these Muslims from around the world to aid in the fight against Afghanistan, they were celebrated as freedom fighters.
Hmm.
Right? But then when their use has expired, then they just changed the jargon and they call them terrorists.
Right, right.
So basically what they were doing is that they didn't need these guys for their war in Afghanistan. And I think what they were essentially doing is that they were bringing these guys from around the world to radicalize them, to prepare enough recruits to be used at the later stage post Afghanistan to then embark on a new stage of this plan, which is the war on terror.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting idea, definitely, because we know that, you know, things are planned ahead, obviously, and they need to start working on, you know, well, again, I go back to the same idea of religion in that sense, or that, you know, the agenda of how you radicalize any movement, you know, but how can you go from something that is proponent of you know, peace and harmony, if we talk about, you know, the true, or whatever you want to call it, Christianity of Jesus or whatever. How can you turn that into a murderous machine that's, you know,
the... How do you turn a Muslim into a terrorist?
Right. Well, exactly. And again, it really is up to, because again, if there's no soldiers, so to speak, there will be no wars. But again, through the art of manipulation and, making people to mind control, of course, and make people, feel dedicated to the cause of either the nation or the religion or what have you. That's where things are faulty. The fact that the people fall for the agenda over and over and over again. And that's really the main cause of the problem. If people disconnect themselves from that and don't feel their allegiance to it, it won't be any further wars. That's really kind of what I see as if we were to talk about some of the solutions to all of this, is that the people are too prone to just throw themselves into dedicating themselves rather to a religion or an allegiance without even knowing what they're really kind of signing up for. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, it's being careful of not, you know, that's why I quote a line at the beginning of my book, you know, from the Quran that basically says, you know, you'll see him who is going to impress you with his jargon, you know, he's going to impress you with his language, but, you know, there's nothing but, I can only paraphrase it, but it's just a lie. There's just nothing but evil in his heart, you know.
Mm.
It's like, there's nothing but deception. That it's just people being aware that just because somebody calls himself Christian, that doesn't mean that, you know, he could be using that as a tool to deceive you, you know, to basically gain your trust. And that's ultimately what people have to, you know, they have to learn to measure people according to their justness, you know, not just because they, or what they say they are and do.
Of course not. Exactly. You're absolutely right. I think, David, that's a good place here to begin to round things up here for this time. And as always, there's so much information, obviously, that we've, you know, kind of quickly waded through. And there's a lot of research and studying that people need to do on their own to all of this, obviously, to get the full picture or to, you know, obviously read up on your book and some of the material that you have on your website in order to, you know, if they feel that this is correct, if it's not or whatever. But there's definitely interesting, you know, story, so to speak, here of what history is, and the main outline of what I guess we can talk about is that there's so much more going on in the world under the surface, behind the veil, so to speak, of where we're going.
Behind the media.
Yes, of course, behind the propaganda, behind everything, everything that is set up to kind of deceive us. And it's interesting go ahead.
It's not hard to discover.
No, it isn't.
You just have to probe. All the information's there. You can Google it. It'll come up first ranking, you know. All you have to do is just not, this is the problem, is just not rely on the mainstream media.
Yes.
And that's how it works.
And also we're in a, you know, fine position, as it were, right now. There's, as you say, so much information out there available. There's so many books on these subjects, and also the fact that much information, I should say, is coming to the surface at this point, meaning that we should also allow ourselves to dive into certain areas of history and allow ourselves to, you know, make mistakes, as it were, as well. We need to realize that we cannot build a picture of world history in a day and suspect that everything's going to be fine and we can figure it all out. There's a lot of interesting hidden agendas, you know, behind that, and there's infighting going on the top levels of this, of course, as well, of who gets to, you know, rule the planet. That seems to be kind of the end game of the whole spiel going on here. But anyway, what we can say is that people who are interested can go over to your website, of course. They can read Terrorism and the Illuminati straight on your website. There's a lot of information for people there. You also have the book The Dying God available. And give us your website again, David, before we end things here for this time.
Right, Terrorism Illuminati is www.terrorism-illuminati.com. And my other book is at thedyinggod.com. So www.thedyinggod.com.
Brilliant. Okay. Keep up the good work, David. It's I'd love to have you back at some point talking more about some of the details. There's a lot of things that we can dive into a little bit more in depth with, so to speak, and wait out some of these interesting points that we've gone over here today. But again, thank you very much for coming on the program, and keep up the great work, okay?
Thank you for having me, Henry.
That's our program with David Livingstone. Thank you for spending some of your time with us today. We'll be back on Sunday with Jim Elwidge. We're going to change the topic completely and talk about the technological singularity and the idea that this is something that will not happen. We're also going to talk about information flow and how this leads to more and more stress, email interruptions that is clogging up the workday, and rich graphical interfaces on our computers is actually slowing things down and not speeding them up. It's going to be really interesting to hear more about this from Jim Elwidge. On the horizon, we have several interesting guests. Todd Campbell from the blog Peering Through. We hope to get Ben Fairhall back on the show as well soon. We also have Tom Brooks planned to come on to discuss megalithic sites around the British Isles, surveying and the evidence for high civilization. Hugh Montgomery to talk about the Despossini family bloodline, and that the European royal bloodlines actually goes all the way back to Mesopotamia, and the Jesus connection is in there as well. And we have Lynn Marsouli back to talk about his book The Alien Interviews. And this is interviews with people who have had direct contact with UFOs, cattle mutilations, alien implants, abductions, and much more. Something that we haven't talked about on the show for a long time, so that's going to be really interesting. Thank you for listening. My thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. We will be back on Sunday. Until then, take good care.